Hello, everyone.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
Culture.
Competition.
Architecture.
The dirt.
Drinking.
Eating.
Reading.
Thinking.
God, I love the dirt.
Let's not waste any more time.
Let's go straight to the pod.
Thank you all for being here.
We greatly appreciate the support.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
And just trying to like get a sense of what Mackenzie saw and liked is probably one of the most important things that you can do if you're working on a Sandbelt course. And I think somewhere along the line, modern golf course architecture kind of lost a little bit of that stylistic diversity. Some of the best courses really reveal themselves on the second, third, fourth, fifth, 10th, 20th, 50th play.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Tie Podcast. This is Henry Shemp, and today I'm joined once again by Lucas Michel from Melbourne, Australia. Lucas is a design associate with CDP Golf Architecture, and today we talk a lot about a lot of the happenings in the world of architecture right now, particularly from someone's perspective who is in the world of architecture but lives in Australia. There's so many new projects going on in America, and it was interesting to talk to Lucas about just kind of what he's hearing within the industry and through social media about all these different projects, where the real buzz is coming from and which projects there's the most excitement about from those who aren't quite as amongst it as those American golf course architecture hardos are. We also talk a lot about what Lucas is working on at CDP, as well as his competitive game. Lucas continues to compete and play at a high level, which I think is a really neat compliment to his architecture career. So always fun having Lucas on. I think this is something that you can expect a lot of over the coming years. Lucas is a good friend and a really fun person to have on the podcast. So hope you guys enjoyed this episode today. Thank you for listening, as always. And without any further delay, let's get straight to the podcast with Lucas Michel. Yeah, so like that's one of the things I wanted to ask you is there's been so much conversation lately about all of these new builds that have come online here in 2023 and then some of the things that are going to be coming in 24, 25. What, as a guy who is very plugged into the golf course architecture scene but lives in Melbourne, what is sort of the international perception of a lot of what's going on in America, be it what's going on in Aiken, South Carolina and up at the Lido and Florida and all of these different places? What are you hearing from a ever so slight outsider's perspective to all the new build work in America?
Yeah, I mean, it's very exciting, particularly for you guys. There's a little bit of jealousy for someone like me because I kind of want that stuff in my backyard, not in yours. But it's amazing what's going on in the States right now. I mean, so many new projects happening. There must be sort of 50 or so projects under construction that look, and all of them look exciting. Whereas in Australia, you know, there's a handful. I think I can really only think of Seven Mile Beach and Kangaroo Island in South Australia, which they're both sort of resort type golf courses. There's very little like new private clubs coming into fruition, which I think there has to be at some point because, you know, all these golf courses like Metro, where I'm a member, you know, we've just closed our membership to even like, you can't even apply to be a member. And the wait list is probably like 10 years. I know Royal Melbourne's probably 10 or 15 years. Kingston Heath's probably the same. So like all these clubs are full. So I'm just waiting for these new builds to come on. where's the demand? There has to be demand out there. I mean, we're doing a project and we'll probably talk about this at the moment. We're doing a project at the moment. We're building 6 greens in a rich guy's backyard, basically. And I guess that's the sort of stuff that starts happening a little bit here, but there's got to also be the demand, I think, in Australia for some new private courses as well. The newest one of that kind of caliber, you know, comparable to the Sandbelts is probably Cathedral Lodge, which was built in, I'm going to say like 2016 or 2017. And that's a very, very good golf course. But I got to think there's more demand out there. I know there is. So we just got to wait for the supply side to catch up.
Yeah. Again, as someone who's in Melbourne, but very plugged into the golf course architecture scene, I shouldn't have my own opinions here, but I'm curious to hear how you would articulate. So what do you think the forces are that have come to be, especially in America, to have all of these new projects coming together? What do you think that we've learned about architecture over the last 50 years? And some of the cultural themes around maybe what styles of architecture people are into, as well as some of the architects that are really in vogue right now. How do you think through why there's so much of this new work going on at the moment?
Well, I think it kind of started with like Sandhills and Bandon, you know, with the sort of neo-classical kind of golden age sort of style of golf courses coming back into popularity. I think that was like the start of it. And then it seems like a fair bit of the new build based around resort and public play. I mean, I know there's a bunch of Florida projects happening at the moment because a bunch of people moved down there sort of through COVID. And there's obviously a lot of demand for private golf down there as well. But it seems like, you know, places like Aiken, where we're seeing a bunch of, and, you know, they're sort of semi-private, but you can kind of get onto them with some public play. And then the Cabot stuff, I don't know exactly where that is in Florida. So like, is it sort of central Florida?
Yeah, it's West Coast, yeah. The Cabot Citrus over on in the Tampa greater area.
Yeah. So you got that stuff. You got courses at Sand Valley. So it seemed to be like the good stuff seems to be focused around like find great land on sand. It always seems to be on sand and build great courses that people can access, which I think is awesome. I think that's amazing. And so where I started what I was saying was, you know, with Sandhills and Bandon, I think people saw that there was people want to see good golf if it's good enough, and they'll travel there. And, you know, I think there's projects happening in is it Colorado and Texas, like some rural parts of Colorado and Texas in some sort of sandy ground. And it just seems like build it and they'll come if it's good enough. And that's kind of what Bamboo was down here as well. 7 Mile Beach less so, because it's a bit more accessible, but the land is incredible and it will be public play. It's just a little bit easier to get to than some of those places for us anyway, not you guys. But yeah, it seems like people are realizing, the developers are realizing that the golf's great. People are going to travel to get there. It doesn't really matter where it is.
Within the context of Australia, how do you think about how social media has had an effect on these things? Because that's where my mind goes. You're talking about all of this, build it and people will come. I have a lot of the same opinions, and I don't think these are hot takes, but it all kind of goes back to the sandy golf and people recognizing what sort of properties you need to find. But I think a massive piece in all of this is you can build another golf course in rural Colorado, and if people start to see great pictures of it and hear really good things, they will travel. So again, just within the context of Australia, do you see a lot of the same? So certainly a project you worked on, 7 Mile, is there a big push to make sure that people have their eyes on it and it's not just simply word of mouth?
Yeah, I remember talking to Matt Goggin early days with the project, and, you know, he was actually a little bit cautious of not showing too much. I think he wanted a little bit of mystery to it. And I think that changed along the way when I started. I mean, I've taken probably the bulk of the photos that have been posted on social media. But I know he was like, okay, I don't want to post any photos of these few holes, because I want, when people come to 7 Mile, I want them to not know what they're going to get at least a few times around, because, you know, obsessed golfers are going to just trawl the Instagram of 7 Mile and see every hole. And I think the best thing about golf sometimes is when you see something you're not expecting, like when you go to a new golf course and you almost don't know anything about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you kind of discover it yourself. And I think that's what he was going for a little bit. But then I think along the way, he got caught up in the pretty photos that I took. And he's probably posted a little bit more than he maybe intended to initially. And I think that was kind of the Bamboogle model of marketing. I think it was, a lot of it was word of mouth. Like Richard Sattler didn't really advertise or market at all. Like golf course magazines were calling him up every day, you know, after it was built, asking, you know, basically for money for them to advertise his golf course. And he was not interested. He just was like, nah, if it's good enough, people are going to come down and play it. And I think Mike Clayton having the name he had and has probably helped that in its early days. Obviously Mike being, you know, a great player at the time, he was sort of coming to the end of his career. He was well known in Australian golf. He was doing some commentary stuff around Australian tour events. Obviously, his writing was in newspapers and magazines. So I think Mike sort of helped create this organic marketing for Barnboogle. And I think that's sort of happened as well with 7 Mile. It's almost like relying a lot on, I think, Mike Clayton's word of mouth and you know, social media posts here and there. But there's no real social media strategy other than maybe to try and not post too much. I think within Australia, it's an extremely exciting project. And I don't think they're struggling. I don't think once it opens, I don't think they'll be struggling to fill a T-sheet. And I don't think they're too worried about that. I think Matt kind of knows it's good enough and it doesn't need that so much. And it's not as competitive of a marketplace as it is in the States. So, yeah.
What is the status update on 7 Mile? Like, lay out the path for me from where we're at now to first shots being hit. And then will there be kind of a phased in play of preview play up until when everything is fully operational?
It's been a slow build. Like, there's been a lot of setbacks along the way. The biggest thing at the moment is water, getting enough of it on the golf course. There's good wells, like they're just drawing from the aquifer, and that's, you know, the quality of the water there is good, but it's just getting enough out of the ground that's been a challenge. And surprisingly, you know, Tasmania is quite a wet island, but the area of Hobart is like in a rain shadow, so they hardly get any rain. So natural rainfall has been a real challenge. It's been a really dry year in terms of, like, I think there's been around 10 inches of rain this year from January to December. So that's hardly anything when you're trying to grow in a golf course. So they've really had to try and ramp up irrigation and get the thing growing in. So at the moment, there's 16 holes shaped and seeded, and there's two that are still yet to be seeded that Mike DeVries went back for Christmas, and he's coming back, I think, mid-January to finish them off. So I think the last holes will be seeded sometime in February. But they're looking at preview play sort of in February, March. There's an 8-hole loop that should be good to go. Well, it pretty much is good to go now, I think. So they're talking about preview play on the 8-hole loop. And then there's another 3 holes that would get mature enough shortly after that, I'd imagine. So that would make a 11-hole loop, and then the remainders will probably come online when it's ready to open. They're looking at sort of November, December next year, so roughly 12 months or so. So it's coming along. It's just been slow. Irrigation, getting enough water has been the challenge.
Okay, well, I apologize in advance for this, but we've been talking the DIRT, but we also have to hit the DERT, of course. It's a rite of passage at the Thai podcast. So Lucas, this mm-hmm. is, I think it's your third time potentially. So you've had a couple goes here. Tell me what you've been drinking, eating, reading, and thinking lately.
So drinking, I don't know when I was last on, but I bought a coffee machine. It was actually this time last year for Christmas, like a Breville, it's called the Breville dual boiler, and it's a great, you know, espresso machine, consumer grade sort of espresso machine. So that's been fun to play with, learning all the ins and out of espresso making, you know, dosing and grind size and kind of dialing that in was really fun. And then now I'm like doing the latte art side of things and getting good at that. So that's always fun. I always go to bed thinking about my morning coffee now. Like, I'm like, can't wait to like get the head to hit the pillow and get to sleep so I can have that morning coffee in the morning, which is kind of, I'm a little bit obsessed. So we got a local roaster near where I live, so just pick up the beans from there. I think they're like from East Timor, like fairly, like, I guess near Indonesia, so fairly kind of obscure location of beans, but they're really good. And you know, they're really focused on ethically and sustainably sourcing all their beans and stuff. So they're a good one to support because they're local. So that's kind of the drinking. Haven't really, other than, you know, your water, and here's my Oakmont US Amateur.
Some nightmares there.
Not great memories, actually, when I look at that cup. but that's the drinking front. Eating, I kind of got like into when I'm home. The tough thing is eating well when you're on the road and traveling. Like, I've been traveling a fair bit back and forth from a project in country Victoria, and I would say the culinary delights of country Victoria don't quite match the Melbourne CBD options. So basically, I'm just obviously making food when I'm there because the town of Euroa, which is near, yeah, doesn't have many options. So I got a little seafood pasta that I like to whip up with some chili and lemon and parsley and some Parmesan cheese. I've got a local, like where I live is quite ethnically diverse. So there's like kind of, there's a bunch of really good restaurants, but there's also this Korean butcher that I go to where they have like, they sell like pre-marinated meats. So I buy the like spicy pork bulgogi meat and then just fry that up with some sesame seeds and some vegetables and onion and yeah, and it's like amazing. And I think it's like in terms of dollars, like it's per service like $3 or $4 of meat and then some rice, like, and then just some kimchi with that as well, which I love. And yeah, that's kind of the eating front, other than like eating out every now and then. I went last on Friday. I went with my girlfriend to a place in town called Supernol. Shout out to I don't know if he's a listener actually. He's Paul, name's Paul Graham, Scottish guy. He's a member at Gullen, but he lives in Australia now, and he's the manager at Supernormal. So big GCA golf guy. So I'm playing golf with him this morning out at RACV Healesville after we have our chat. So yeah.
What kind of food it's super normal.
I would say Japanese based, but like I would, it's fusion. Like there's a lot of other sort of, like I think we had this lamb dish that was probably more like Western Chinese. Like it was kind of like had some like Western sort of like almost Indian spices in it. It was like kind of like a curry. So that was really cool. But then you've obviously got like the sashimis and what else we have? We had some dumplings. Yeah, it's kind of a bit of everything, but I think they base themselves in like Japan. Like, and the kind of the vibe of the place is very much like it's like, you know, Japanese video games kind of around the place. And it's one of those ones on Flinders Lane, which I know you've been to kind of near Chin Chin and those ones. So yeah, it's really cool.
Awesome. Reading, anything on the reading
R
front or
reading.
listening to? Yeah, I know that in the
Yeah.
architecture world, I hear a lot of audiobooks on the dozers. That's a common thread.
It is, yeah. No, I have been reading a little bit. I bought the Tom Simpson book, which the name's escaping. I think it's just called Golf Architecture, possibly. I'm trying to remember. I've got it somewhere in here. That's a good one. I love, and it's not really reading because, but his sketches are amazing in that book. Like his ability to draw golf holes and really like sort of illustrate what he's looking at and what he's trying to show on the ground in three dimensions is really cool. So that I really like kind of his ability to sketch that stuff. And I've been sort of playing around with sketching some stuff in the field for shapers that we're using, because on this project I haven't been probably in the field as much. I've had some tournaments to play, like played last week in the Sandbelt, I played the Asia Pacific. So I've had the project on. I haven't been able to shape everything myself. So I've been sort of like trying to do the Tom Simpson style sketches in the field to show what I want bunkers to look like and contours and slopes. So really enjoying his writing, but also his illustrative abilities. They're amazing. Yeah, that's been the main one. I got the Mackenzie Reader as well. So that's a good one to flick through every now and then. You know, if you've read Spirit of St. Andrews and his 1920 book, I think it's called Golf Architecture. That if you've read those two, it's kind of you kind of know what to expect. It's sort of the same stuff, but there's some new stuff in there, and it's really well produced. It's a really nice book. Like it looks really old and nice. So that's a good one to flick through as well.
Nice.
Thinking. What am I thinking about? I've been busy on projects lately, so. I mean that there is time in the dozer and in the posi track and excavator to think. If I'm not listening to music, or well, even when I'm listening to music, I've been probably been thinking. I still I still come back to like, I still think about how do I get better at golf? Like, I don't know what it is. Like, I'm still obsessed with like, even though I'm not playing as much or competing as much, when I'm like, find myself just like, I don't know, thinking up in the clouds, like it's always about like, how do I get better at golf? It's weird. I think it's just wired. I think I'm just wired that way. So I've just been thinking about like little parts of my swing and my game that I could be improving on. It's funny, my ball striking at the moment is like probably almost the best it's ever been, which is kind of crazy because I'm probably hitting the least amount of balls that I've ever hit. So it's mainly just thinking about how do I get my short game back? How do I get my putting sharp again and my chipping? So that's kind of where the thinking's at, interestingly.
Awesome. Well, there's a lot of stuff there, especially in the reading and thinking that I want to hit in the next kind of 30 minutes or so. But I want to start with your conversation there on Tom Simpson. So you're with Clayton DeVries and Pont. I know you guys do a decent bit of work in Australia, but a lot of it being focused around GB&I, continental Europe, and Tom Simpson. Americans may or may not be super familiar with his work, but super important architect in GB&I and continental Europe. So the question is, do you find it important to understand an architect who has had a lot of influence on areas that you're doing a lot of work?
Yeah, I think that's important. I mean, I don't personally work on any Simpson courses, but I know that Frank has worked on quite a few. I think Le Touquet and Hardelot in France are both Simpson courses. And I know Frank probably has more of a focus on Harry Colt, and he's like pretty much a Colt expert. Like he could tell you probably almost like what he had every meal of his life kind of stuff. Like it's he's got a lot of knowledge around Harry Colt, but obviously, Colt and Simpson were, close as well. So, yeah, Frank definitely. I know he does a lot of research on Simpson stuff. He's done stuff at Cruden Bay as well, which Simpson worked on, and I think he did the little short course there, which I played, which is awesome. I think it is important to understand the architects, like even in Australia, Simpson, not Simpson, Mackenzie's influence in Australia is probably the biggest one. So I think just every time you look around the Melbourne Sandbelt, you're seeing stuff that's been influenced by Mackenzie. And then going out and seeing, say, Cypress Point and Augusta and, Crystal Downs, and just trying to like get a sense of what Mackenzie saw and liked is probably one of the most important things that you can do if you're working on a Sandbelt course as well. Like we're now the consulting architects at Woodlands Golf Club in Melbourne. And although not Mackenzie, directly Mackenzie influence being on the Melbourne Sandbelt, you kind of want to put on the ground the principles that Mackenzie espoused in and amongst Australia. So yeah, I think you've got to do the research to really know what you're putting on the ground that's going to be reflective of what those architects wanted.
So bridging off what you're saying there about Mackenzie, both in Australia and then in the States as well, like how do you think about Mackenzie's architecture within the context of the way that golf plays in the sand belt, where it's very firm and the greens play quick, and a lot of the time you're chasing balls into greens and through fairways and whatnot. And then if you play certain courses of his in America, you don't see quite as much of that. Do you feel as if his style of architecture works much better for the sand belt versus in America, or is it vice versa? Have you ever really thought about the comparison and contrast between those two?
Yeah, I think Mackenzie was always one that he wanted to promote, and every architect talks about it, but promoting, playable golf for the masses, but still challenging the best players. And so a lot of his architecture has open greens at the front where a ball can run through, but then, tricky, challenging pin positions and contours within the greens that make putting and short game shots really interesting. And so I think, thinking about how that shows on the sandbelt with the open fronts, I mean, it's very rare in America to think about landing a ball short of a green and running it up. So I think you do miss a little bit of that in the way courses are conditioned over there. Whereas in Australia, obviously, we've got a real focus on firm and fast golf, but also we have a great climate, particularly in Melbourne, that allows that. So I do think that Australian golf kind of the way it's presented, I think heightens the architecture or heightens the way it plays and the playability. I just think it plays way more interesting when you're thinking about where the ball's landing, how it's running out, how it's releasing, rolling. Could it run into that bunker? Could it run over the back? There's so much more to think about when the ball's running on the ground. And I think that's something that I think Mackenzie wanted in his golf sort of course presentation. And I don't think he always gets that in the States, but in Australia, he definitely does.
Is that a conversation that you're ever having with clients of, almost an expectation management or what have you in different areas that you've worked in, where, say, a client comes to you that happens to be in a part of the UK that maybe isn't quite as firm and fast as Melbourne, for example, and they say, "Hey, I want this thing to be rock hard and ball to be rolling around and all of these sorts of things." And do you ever have to say, "This is kind of what we can do based on what we're working with?"
I think you're always thinking about that. You're always working with a superintendent to try and understand what's possible everywhere. And you're building features to match that. So, if it's a place where, it's going to be, they've got high rainfall, cooler weather, where it's not going to get as fiery, then you might build some more extreme stuff. You might build some greens that run away a little bit more to promote the ball bouncing and running when it hits the turf. You can definitely do stuff within design to help that, but if a club has the resources, generally, I mean, we've all seen it at Augusta with the sub air and stuff. Places can get firm if they really want to, and if they're willing to spend the budget and do the right things agronomically, then they can kind of these days they can almost achieve anything. But yeah, there are times where you definitely probably need to push back. If they're talking, "Oh, we want, the greens to be like Royal Melbourne, and I want to bounce a ball on the green," was like, "Well, that's not going to happen here." Yeah, I think you can kind of do it with, some expectation management, but then you can definitely build features that play to run out more in certain areas, which might help to promote that sort of ground game and interest and thought.
Kind of bringing together both your playing background as well as architecture, do you have any sort of a sense of what style of golf you want to build long term, or is that much more of a, hey, you take the work that you get and sort things out as you go?
I think so far in what I've done, I've been very much client focused. So, trying to, I think it's just the same for anyone who's starting the business. You kind of want to keep your clients happy. And so, I've done a few projects lately that have been private sort of deals where I know that not the general public aren't really going to play it. It's going to be like, it's like one client. So like I built 18 greens for a guy on his property. He's got a par three course in country Victoria. And I know that like no one's really going to see that golf course, and it's not going to reflect necessarily that poorly on me if people don't like it. So there I went kind of crazy and did some really wild stuff that I would never do anywhere else. And that's something that the client wanted. He wanted like drama. He kept saying, give me drama on these greens. So we kind of went over the top, and it's kind of insane. Like I went and checked it out yesterday. I went for a little walk around and I was like, sheesh, what was I thinking here on some of those spots? But the
Like
client
the
loves it.
famous A.W. Tillinghast, the greens are a direct product of how many he had the night before, some of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it honestly looks like that. I don't know what I was on when I was there, but it looks interesting. So, but the client loves it there. And like looking at it now, I'm like, ooh, I don't like that at all, but he loves it, and that's what he wanted. And then this other project in country Victoria, there's a little bit of that as well. We're getting a little bit more of a freer hand, and this one's with Clayton. So the first one was I was kind of just by myself on it. This one's with Mike. So I'm also thinking, what is Mike like? And I know that I can't be as crazy as I was on the other one because Mike's gonna cut that down, and if there's mounds in every green like I did on the other project. So I'm trying to keep sort of Mike happy, knowing what Mike's eyes like and what Mike likes, and then the client as well has given us a little bit of our own freedom there, so we can kind of build stuff that we like. I've sort of forgotten your question though. Have I answered it? I can't remember now.
Yeah, more or less. Was just kind of asking like how much of fit as an architect bears directly on what the client's looking for versus you kind of creating a keener sense over time of the type of work you want to do. I guess like another question on top of that I've been thinking about, just bring, you know, I'm kind of making my way around things here with everything that you've been talking about so far. Like some of the courses we talked about before, some of the new builds, some of the really popular architects of the moment. Is there anyone in particular that you look up to right now that you like what they're doing? You like their path? You like the sorts of courses that they're doing or where they've consulted? Do you think about those sorts of things much as a young architect?
I mean, obviously, I've got to talk about Mike Clayton and Mike DeVries because they're the ones I've learned the most from. I mean, Clayton in terms of the theory of design, and then Mike DeVries, you know, working in the field in construction and seeing how he executes things. But I think the one I like listening to the most, and I love what Andy Johnson does with particularly with the Fried Egg and the Yoke with Doak. And like I'll go back and listen to Yokes with Doak from like 5-6 years ago when he first started it. And like I can't get enough of listening to Tom Doak just talk about golf course design. I think it's fascinating. And he really thinks about trying to do different stuff all the time. Like it's not, you know, he doesn't want to put himself in a box and you know, say this is a Tom Doak golf course. He's always trying to do something different. And I think that's a really cool way to be. So, you know, if you were to look at these two courses that I've done that are literally 25 minutes away from each other. So, you know, the 18-hole par 3 course and the 6-green kind of practice course thing, you would definitely not think they're by the same guy. Like they look completely different. So I think I kind of like that stylistically, kind of like the stylistic chameleon to just sort of like really do different stuff everywhere you go. I think that's a really cool way to do it. I think Brian Snyder does that really well too, and he does some really wacky stuff. We were talking about it before you hit record, but like Old Barnwell, that's somewhere I really want to see. And I think somewhere along the line, modern golf course architecture kind of lost a little bit of that stylistic diversity. You know, you look at some of the older, really old courses, you know, National Golf Links and then like the Langford Moreau stuff. Some of that really like severe kind of wacky built stuff where it's, you know, really steep, almost unmowable bunker faces and, you know, mounding, you know, some of the Walter Travis sort of mounding and weird bunkers. I don't know. I think golf course architecture kind of went missing for 50 years or longer. And it's cool to see some of that stuff come back. So I would actually like to bring some of that stuff down under, because Australia has been very heavily influenced by Alistair McKenzie. And so you don't actually see a lot of that kind of wacky, unnatural architecture much at all here. It's all very smooth and kind of naturalist McKenzie style. So it'd be cool to do something where we kind of bucked the trend a little bit down here and built maybe something that resembled an old Barnwell or a Walter Travis course or, a OCM did Lonsdale Links, which is kind of like a Seth Rayner inspired design. Even something like that, another one like that would be pretty cool.
So you and I have discussed that before, like offline, of there just haven't been many new builds in Melbourne. There's so many great golf courses in the Sand Belt that are all much older, but over the last however many years, there just haven't been any new builds. Like, do you have any sense around, is it a lack of funding from clients? Is it like city mandate on not being able to build on plots of land where these great golf courses have been? Like, do you have any answer as to why maybe people haven't been given plots of land to build golf on like they seem to be doing in the States as much?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. I can't put my finger on it yet. I think it will happen. I just think we might be lacking a little bit. Like we do get calls and we get emails and it'll be from kind of dreamer types, I think, sometimes, who, you know, I want to build a course here. And I guess somewhere along the lines they get caught up with whether it's funding or whether it's, yeah, you know, getting approvals from local towns or whatever it is. There's obviously some sort of filter along the way that stops them from actually finishing the job and getting to construction. So I don't know quite know what it is, but hopefully we do start seeing some of those things come online, because we have that there is a little bit of interest bubbling behind the scenes, but it's just waiting for a few of them to take off, because they do seem to get caught up somewhere.
What do you think? What are you most excited about right now that that CDP is working on?
Personally, we've got five greens, hopefully, fingers crossed, that we're going to build in July, August at Royal Perth, which it's a pretty cool course. It's on 82 acres, 18 holes, which is like probably one of the smallest sites I could ever
82
imagine.
82 acres. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I was just doing a piece on Marion. Marion's known to be, at least in the States, like one of the tightest properties. It's 126. So 82, that's a whole lot smaller than that.
Yeah. And most of the sand belts are around that 120 mark, including driving ranges. So, you know, I think Kingston Heath's around 120, Commonwealth, Yarra Yarra, Huntingdale, they're all kind of the same. So 82 acres, a lot of it comes down to the safety piece. Like, you can't do too much, because anytime you change something, you know, under current situation, there aren't too many safety issues, although we've identified some. If you go and change something, someone gets hit by a golf ball, you're pretty much liable for that if you've changed anything with the golf course. So we're trying to be really careful of what we change. So it's going to be largely just greens and bunkers there. But the actual routing works pretty well. I mean, as you can imagine, it's kind of, a little, as someone described it to me, as like a pack of sausages. So it's, you know, like just golf holes just running up and down kind of along the same parallel. So it's a little bit like that. So it's not the most interesting routing, but you almost can't do that with a rectangular plot on 82 acres. Like, there's only so much you can do, but we're adding a little bit of more diagonal elements to the routing with our design. And Mike Clayton and Mike DeVries came up with the sort of routing concept, but the first step of the way is going to be rebuilding five greens that we don't have to move much at all. And there'll be a tiny bit of tree removal, but it'll be basically greens and bunkers, and it's all in sand. And I think I'm going to be doing basically all the shaping because Mike D is pretty busy. So I'm really looking forward to that. I think that's going to be a cool one to, you know, I've cut my teeth a little bit on some projects, but I've quickly realized that sand is just the dream to work with, because this latest project has just been really rocky, crappy clay, and it's been horrendous stuff to work with. So I'm looking forward to jumping in the dozer and not having to worry about, you know, trying to move a mountain of clay, which is just a nightmare. So yeah, that'll be really fun to cut my teeth on there. So that'll be mid-year. I know that in Europe they've got some stuff happening with Spey Bay, which is the Lynx Dow kind of project. I forget what they actually call them. So it says you know, they bought a course basically with cryptocurrency at Spey Bay, and they've hired CDP to redesign it and rebuild it. So I think that's happening. It might be this winter, but I don't know if it's going to be all the works. I need to kind of, I haven't kept totally up to date with that one, but that's going to be pretty cool. I know that Frank and Mike D have had some cool routing concepts there, where they're building a few extra greens and getting things kind of with, you know, basically a flexible routing that can be played somewhat backwards, and with the extra greens, you can really change it up day to day. So that looks like a really cool one. We've got another course in Perth, which is one of the coolest projects to me, because it's somewhere where I learned to play golf. It's a public facility. It's actually 36 holes on about 350 acres. So we've got plenty of land, and we've got a concept, hopefully, that we might, you know, take the 36 hole facility and break it up a little bit and retain the original 18 hole course, but then build a extra pitch and putt and a par three course. So it'll end up being like a 54-hole facility with you'll go there, and rather than having to choose between playing 9 holes or 18 holes, you'll be able to choose between, okay, how long do I have? I've got 45 minutes. Okay, I'll go do the 12-hole pitch and putt. Or if I've got 2 hours, okay, I'll play 9. I've got 3 hours, I'll play 12. I've got 4 hours, I'll play the full 18. So you'll have like a number of different options. And it's almost like difficulties as well, because if you're a beginner, you might want to stay out on the pitch and putt or the, you know, 9-hole short course. So I think that's a really, really cool one that we're hoping to to be able to do, but that'll sort of be a couple of years from now. But that's something I'm looking forward to, because yeah, I literally learned how to play the game there. That's where I first got lessons. It was about 10 minutes from where I went to school. And yeah, so it'd be cool to spend some time in Perth and work on that.
How far is it from Melbourne to Perth? I know Perth is known to be like the most remote major city in the world.
It's about 4 hours on a plane. So it's kind of almost like traveling east to west coast in the States. It's not quite as far, but it's pretty close. So yeah, it's a long way. And there's not that much out there. And Western Australia is a place, like, if you're going to build a remote golf course, that would be, I mean, there is hundreds of kilometers of perfect sand dunes on the coast. And we've checked it out, and there's definitely, I mean, we had a farmer call us about 12 months ago to ask us, you know, to go check out his site, because he went to Barnbougle and played some golf, and he said, wait a minute, I've got this in my backyard. So we went and checked it out, and it's amazing land. And you know, there's literally hundreds of kilometers of coastline like that. It's just people, population size is the issue there, and places like King Island have struggled with that as well, getting enough people down to the island. So getting enough people to certain remote parts of Western Australia where you can build the golf is probably part of the issue. It's a little further from the States as well, so it's a little bit trickier to get that international kind of demographic. It's closer to England, I suppose, so you could get people that want to fly on the world's longest commercial airline flight of 18 hours, London to Perth. But yeah, it's that's the challenging aspect.
Yeah, cool. And now a quick word about our friends at Good Walk Coffee. Mr. Simus, what's your coffee game been like recently?
Man, I always, and I mean always, have the Mudball Half Calf on me. I've been loving the bump and run cold brews on the go, and lately, it's been the breakfast ball.
Give me a little bit more color on the bump and run cold brew.
Well, I love making coffee at home, but I can't do it all the time. And when I really got to move and I need my Good Walk, I reach straight in the fridge, grab a can, and go, and I get exactly what I need.
Where can the people go if they want to get involved with our friends at Good Walk Coffee?
You can purchase all your coffee, cold brew, espresso, pods, cases, beans, merch, and more for 20% off using code THETIE. That is THETIE at checkout. Set your custom subscription. The world is yours only at goodwalkcoffee.com.
Well, let's move on and talk about competitive golf here briefly before we wrap up. I'm curious to hear how you're situating your career as an architect versus continuing to play very high level amateur golf. You've had a really solid year. I was looking at your Wagger ranking heading into this, and a lot of good golf as of late. And so, you know, how are you thinking about that? Like, are you being able to practice a decent bit right now, or is your focus mostly on architecture and then a little bit of competitive golf on the side? And if that's the case, do you think that there's something about that makes some sense, that, you know, as you've continued to focus more on architecture, that the competitive golf has kind of taken an uptick all the while?
Yeah, it ebbs and flows a little bit, my ability to play and practice. Good thing is we do tend to build a lot of our work in our winters here. So, you know, being able to practice more, I suppose, in the right times of the year where you can get up and gear up your game for playing tournament golf. So obviously most of our tournaments are in sort of Jan, Feb. And if I'm playing and practicing because I don't have many projects where I need to be on site, then that's a good thing. It's kind of a funny one at the moment. I've been, helping build this six-hole kind of deal for this guy. And I've had the Asia Pacific Amateur, I've had the Sandbelt Invitational, I'm going to have the Australian Amateur and the Master Amateurs all kind of running through the construction phase. So it's been a really interesting one of how do you, and luckily it's within driving distance, it's 2 hour drive, but it's been a really interesting one to learn on, because it's like, okay, how can I be as hands off as possible, but still get the best possible product as well? So I was sort of saying, you know, trying to draw things like Simpson did in his books, and I'm sure he drew stuff for clients as well on how to build features, has been kind of a fun part of sort of the learning process. But yeah, my game seems to be seems to be pretty steady. Like it, you know, I've struggled a little bit in the US mid-am the last few years. It's in a bad time. It is like it's right out of the middle of winter for us. And I don't know how I won it that year because it's just there's nothing on in Australia right before we play it. So, but yeah, I do find that my game definitely gears up come summer. And I had a really good summer last year with just some really solid results, you know, some top tens and some really strong fields. So yeah, it's been a challenging one trying to figure out my game. And it's funny, like the less I'm playing, I think the more I learn about how my game works and how to keep it going. And I think when you're playing a lot, you just kind of naturally fall into being able to play decent all the time. But when you really got that constraint of having to manage your time, you kind of figure out these are the things I need to do to get my game in shape for events. And it's definitely more based around my short game than anything else I've found lately.
And so would you say with your short game, that's the part of the game that you're going to be actively practicing and trying to tune up going into a tournament, and then your ball striking, that's what's going to kind of more or less be there for you? Yeah.
Yeah. I've found my ball striking. I've found there's basically like three things that creep into my game with my ball striking, and I just keep an eye on those. And then with my short game, it's just putting in the reps prior to a tournament. So there's not too much that like, there's nothing that like creeps in that like technically is bad with my short game. It's just not literally not chipping and putting and pitching enough that causes me issues. And then I'll hit one bad shot and I'll lose confidence. And then it's no good from there on the golf course. So yeah.
God, I know what you're talking about. I was, I was playing this past weekend, and the listeners of the podcast know I am not some short game wizard, but I've been a lot better over the last handful of months, been working on some technique that's been working really nicely for me. But I got over this like tight cut pitch shot a few days back, and I was like, man, I haven't looked down at one of these in like 4 weeks. Didn't hit it so well, and the rest of the day was history. Just no good at all. So yeah, I can totally understand how that goes. What ball striking wise, is there anything going into a tournament that you might think a little bit more about, be it your driver, your irons, or do you feel generally speaking, like when the gun goes off, you get out there, you kind of know what to expect and how to manage around the course reasonably well?
Yeah, I think I do. I know that for me, like there are things that creep in technically. Like my takeaway can get a little bit inside and fanny, like the club face opens up a bit. And then my posture, like I can get a little bit high with the right hip. So I kind of need to bump my left hip forward, and my ball position can sometimes creep forward. So they're kind of like three things that I always sort of think about. But I know that if I kind of get them in the right place, then it can't get too far off. And I think, I don't know, it's weird. Like I literally don't hit any range balls now. Like I just go and play golf holes. And that, 'cause that's like, for me, like I'll almost lose myself on the range. Like I'll lose what I'm doing on the range. Whereas if I'm on the golf course, I can still troubleshoot a little bit, but I'm not like, I don't find myself getting lost with my swing or with my game as much. So I'll just go on the golf course and hit shots. And that seems to be what's working for me with my ball striking. We'll see if it lasts, but it seems pretty sustainable right now, which is good.
How much do you think about with competitive golf going forth? You know, you mentioned it earlier that in your thinking, you still think a lot about just improvement, about how to get better at golf. To what degree would you say competition going forward is A, just pure enjoyment, loving to compete, B, having legitimate goals around finishes, wins, or what have you, and C, just purely wanting to continue to see, hey, what might it look like for me to continue to improve my ability to compete?
Yeah, I think there's like, it's almost just like a curiosity around it. I'm just sort of interested to just see how my game changes over time. Like I am obviously interested in trying to keep it as good as possible. And there's certain goals around that. Like I would like to play, and they're hard to qualify but more of those Asian amateur tournaments, because you just get to travel to some really cool places. Like it's in Japan next year, which I'd love to go back to Japan. And I've played a tournament there once before in 2015. I'd love to go back. There's certain goal, like little goals around that, like trying to play good enough to qualify for that stuff. But knowing that, look, I'm playing nowhere near as much as these kids, you know, and they are kids, like they're in their late teens, early 20s that are qualifying for these. Like, I think I'm the oldest guy by like 7 years in the latest Asian AM team. So it's like, it's just trying to, yeah, like they're sort of like somewhat the goals, but I think I'm just interested to see how my game develops over time and to keep working on it, kind of how I'm doing it. I'm just interested to see what happens. I know that, you know, it seems to be working right now, but you know, we've been busy, but as things could ramp up a lot more. And certainly when I was 8 months away at 7 Mile in last year, I mean, my game was horrible when I got out of that. And I tried to play Erin Hills like literally 2 weeks after finishing up at 7 Mile, and I was nowhere near it. So it definitely can impact it. But I think I've learned a lot along the way, even through that process, because never before had I spent that long away from the game. Now I'm more detached from the game, so I think I know how to manage my game through that sort of stuff. And I would be surprised if I did 8 months on the road sort of ever again, because I think it'll be more sort of fly in, fly out sort of stuff. So yeah, there is some curiosity, I think, more than anything, to see how my game changes. But I do think about it a lot.
When you show up to an event like Erin Hills and the game is just flat, not there, and you're shooting just not good numbers, like for you, obviously no one enjoys not playing well, but is that a purely like, man, I really want to be doing something else sort of experience? Or do you have kind of a mental reconciliation piece where you can kind of say, hey, look, this isn't good, but like, I'm still enjoying being able to get out here and compete and at least see what I've got, even if the answer is more or less nothing?
I think during the tournament rounds, it was hard to have any positive attitude toward the golf that I was playing because it was so bad. It was almost to the extent it was so bad, it was humorous. So there was almost that side of things. But it wasn't overly enjoyable. But once I left the golf course, it was a quick turnaround. And, you know, I was traveling, you know, around that area of the States. I'd never been to Wisconsin. I went up to Sand Valley. I went to Lasonia. Like, I did these really cool things afterwards. So it was kind of like the silver lining on a couple bad days on the golf course. So in the scheme of things, it was, you know, a fairly minimal load on me mentally. But yeah, it definitely wasn't enjoyable on the golf course. Although, like I said, there was some humor in how badly I was playing.
Yeah, understood. Okay, well, one more question and we'll finish up here. So for kind of a US-based listenership here, a lot of golf course architecture hardos, as someone that's very well traveled within the States, even though you are an Australian, give me just kind of over the last couple of years, like two or three courses that have really stood out to you, maybe that surprised to the upside. I love what you said about, you know, there's something great about maybe not having seen a lot of pictures of courses or seeing things that do truly excite you and that you weren't necessarily expecting. And then kind of the same question on things that you want to see in the States that maybe are brand new or don't have to be new by any means, but courses that you haven't gotten the chance to see yet.
I think there's a few. There's two that are standing out to me from, I think they were the same trip. And it was, we hung out a lot that trip. It was, so one was Pine Needles at I think they're part of the Mid Pines Resort, and I didn't play Mid Pines, but I did play Pine Needles. So I whipped around Mid Pines in a cart just to see it because we didn't have time. But I thought Pine Needles was really, really cool, and you know, it gets a little bit of fanfare, but I guess because it's like the fifth or sixth best course in the area or whatever it is, like it doesn't get anywhere near as much attention as it probably should. Another one that's standing out is Old Town, which I think I just love that place. I'd love to go back. And then another one, which I guess has a little bit of a following, but when I played it the first time, I don't think I appreciated it as much, but Catanzet out in Massachusetts. When I first played it, I guess I was a little bit underwhelmed. Like I'd heard a lot of great things about it, but it's one of those places that I think it gets better and better the more you play it. And when I played it for the second time, I was like, no, this is awesome. Like I just must have missed something. And it's funny, like how, you know, so many of these, I guess, rankings lists are based on, you know, a lot of the time people who are playing somewhere once, but some of the best courses really reveal themselves on the second, third, fourth, fifth, 10th, 20th, 50th play. And that almost makes them better than the ones that reveal themselves all on the first time. So, yeah, Catanzas, it was a place that I was like, I can't believe I got this so wrong. Like, I think it went from, you know, I do the golf magazine rankings, and I think it went from, like, say, you know, it might have been US, I might have put it, say, 75 in the US, and it went to, like, 25 or something on my list, or 50. You know, it jumped a lot in my mind after the second place. So that was another place that comes to mind that maybe doesn't get as much attention. The other one's Sankaty Head out on Nantucket. That place is awesome. I love playing the mid-am there, even though, again, I didn't play very well. That's a place that flies under the radar a bit. I'm trying to think what else. The Creek, which is probably gets a bit of like that Instagram kind of publicity because it is so spectacular when you crest the hill on, I think it's 5 and look down the 6th. That was one that I loved when I played it for the first time. Piping Rock is another one that probably doesn't get. I think Piping Rock, like, is one of the top handful of Rainer courses that I played. Another one, actually, Blue Mound, actually, now that I think of it, Blue Mound probably would be the one that I would call out as like, no, this is like seriously
the
good. I put it
sleeper.
In like,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Blue Mound. And yeah, it's that place is sick. Yeah, actually, that's probably the one. And the superintendent there has it so good. He like, it was a shame we got the worst possible weather, but like in the practice rounds, it was like so good. I would play there like 10 round split between Erin Hills and Blue Mound. It would be like 8-2 Blue Mound. Like it was like, it's awesome. So there's a good little list for you.
Nice. And then on a future trip, which hopefully is not too long, anything, whether it's new or just would be a new course to you that's pretty high on your list?
I think of some of the new build stuff, I definitely want to get to Tree Farm, and shout out based on the hat I'm wearing.
Got the
Tree
hat
Farm,
on. Good man.
And, yeah, and Old Barnwell. They're gonna be an awesome little double. Of ones that I haven't played that are sort of older, I haven't been to Prairie Dunes. That's pretty high on the list. Just hard to get to. Like, there's not that much around there. What else? I need to play the Lido, and it's this is an interesting question. Is that a new course or an old course? But I do want to play the Lido. I actually walked around it when it was in construction when I was up in Wisconsin last year. I don't know, though. Some of the old classic ones, I need to play Cypress. I walked around it in September. Stunning morning for it. The photos I got were incredible. Kind of, I wasn't sure if I wanted to play it first or walk it first. I kind of leaned on the side of like, I want to play it for the first time, but with the morning I got and the light and just walking there, like before anyone went out, it was pretty insane. Like it was an incredible experience, even not being able to hit a shot while I was out there. But it would be nice to go back and play there. But yeah, outside of that, I don't think there's any real ones that I'm really dying to play. I've been fortunate. Shinnecock's one that I haven't played out on Long Island that would have to be up there. But yeah, there's not that much else that I can think of.
Yeah. I do have to follow up with one more question here, because you've mentioned it multiple times, and I hear this a lot and I think about it a lot. As someone who would gather a lot more, both from playing a course and walking a course just a single time than the average person would, how do you situate the difference between those two things? Have you ever walked a course and said like, oh, this is pretty interesting, blah, 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 but then you go play it and you're like, there are so many things that I just could not have picked up on simply being able to look at it. How do you situate those two things and you know, what you can extract from walking versus playing a golf course?
I'm trying to think if I've ever had the experience of walking it and then playing it and then picking up more from playing it than walking it. I don't think I have. I actually think you pick up more in the walking than you could in the playing. I mean, outside of like seeing how certain shots react, but I feel like I've got a good eye for how slopes work now Having built, built features now, I think you get a really good understanding of, that slope's too severe, that's not. So I think, I personally think you get a lot more out of walking, but if you can play it, then you certainly get a slightly richer perspective of how shots kind of react when they hit the ground. But a lot of that's depending on what day you're seeing it as well. Like the day I played Piping Rock, it was like the day after the club championship, and it was like so fiery, and I couldn't believe just like how cool the place was. But then, I think in walking it, you're able to like a little bit kind of dissociate yourself from the conditioning a little bit and see the architecture for what it is. Sometimes I think that's kind of the benefit sometimes of walking it versus playing it. So I don't know. It's an interesting one. I mean, obviously I'm a golfer. I want to play golf courses, not just walk them. But as an architect, I can really appreciate the walking, and you do see more. You're not as distracted, and you get a more educational experience out of it.
Yeah. All right, Lucas. Well, I do have some homework for you for next time you're back. I was thinking about this before. You mentioned the yoke with Doak. I mean, this is your third time already. We're going to have some more. We got to come up with something. We've got the tie. We've got Lucas, Michelle. I don't know what we're going to work on, but I'll keep thinking about it, and we'll come up with a nice little name for it, because always enjoy having you back.
Sounds good. Yeah, maybe ask ChatGPT what it thinks. I reckon it'll come up with something pretty clever. Yeah,
young guys will use a little AI for it. That makes some sense. All right, man. Yeah. Cheers.
Yeah, cheers, Sam.